Hello everyone and welcome back to episode 3 of Psyched to be with you. This is with my very special guest, Dr. Celeste San Giorgio. This was a great chat. We talked about psychology, robotics, the future of like e-health interventions. It was a wild and very interesting time. There's some really, really good work going on and being done here. I'm very, very excited about it. We also talked about some great games. Legend of Zelda came up again. It was awesome. I do just want to say we talk about a little bit of work that may have some sensitive topics. So just a blanket, little content warning. Some stuff does come up. Do look after yourselves. Take a break if you need it. But I hope you guys enjoy this chat as much as I did. And all the links and information, as well as where you can find Dr. Celeste, are all attached to this, wherever you found it. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll see you again soon. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Psyched to be with you. I am incredibly hyped to be here with another very, very special guest. Just a quick bit of housekeeping for those who have hung out on the stream before. Alerts are muted. There are no sound commands today. Alerts will go off though in the corner, so I do appreciate all your support. But this is just meant to be very much a talk show format. And yeah, I'm very excited. This is episode 3, so let's get stuck into it. So I'm going to pass over to my very special guest. If you just mind telling us a little bit about who you are, what you do, and where you go when you're not around.
My name is Celeste San Giorgio. I'm a clinical psychologist, newly minted as of July of this year. Based out of the U.S., specifically Rochester, New York. And as a clinical psychologist, I see patients, but I also do research. And my research is in digital applications of clinical psychology. So AI therapy, avatar-assisted therapy, making platforms for people to access therapy or rehearse it. Yep, that's what I do. And you said what I do when I'm not around?
Yeah.
What do you mean exactly by that?
Well, I honestly, you know, I kind of thought it was a really neat little intro. It's actually a lyric from, you know, the song Dead Ringer by Meatloaf and Cher.
Oh, awesome. I saw Meatloaf once.
Yeah.
I'm
a big fan. Big fan.
Yeah, it was great.
But like, it's a quote from that song. It's like, who you are, what you do, where you go when you're not around. Mm-hmm. And in my head, I thought, that's a great introductory line. But the last bit seems to have confused everyone but me. So I might have to change that. We're a developing craft. So just kind of like, what do you get up to, like very loosely, when you're not doing that?
You know, that's what I thought you probably meant. Okay. When I'm not doing that, I definitely play video games, read. And I draw and exercise a bit.
Awesome stuff.
I'm looking forward to doing all of that a bit more now that I'm done with my PhD.
Nice. Okay, so let's sort of kick off then. You recently graduated. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
For those that haven't caught this before, I've your first year PhD journey, so I'm in awe of anyone that somehow finished it. Can you mind telling us a bit more about what that was in and how that sort of went for you as an experience, obviously with everything that's happened in the world as well?
I'm still coming to terms with it being done. I think it's been such a big part of my life for so long that it's surprising that I can even introduce myself as Dr. San Giorgio. But yeah, so I started in 2015, and I don't know if anyone here is familiar with the process of applying to PhD programs, but you actually apply a year before you get into the program, at least in the US. And so I've actually been doing it for even 2 years before that, if you count the application process. It's been quite long. It's been pretty wonderful to get this training in this area that I really enjoyed. I feel very privileged to have gotten into this and to be able to be trained in it. For clinical psychologists, half of our training is in practice and half of it's in theory with a focus on research. So I spent a lot of time getting clinical hours, and now I'm able to do that in my current work as well, half research, half practice.
I mean, I understand that, you know, there's a lot of confidentiality and stuff around practice, but what's that like, balancing that against like research? Because again, for me, we were talking about it a little bit before we got on air about like the teaching and different, like the differences in like PsyDs and qualifications and PhDs over here. But like mine is just like research, teaching. That's very much the model over here in the UK. So how did you find like doing that clinical work while like, because I mean I'm terrified about doing teaching and research at the same time, let alone really demanding clinical stuff while doing that. How was that?
Yeah, well, it's definitely a lot to balance. And I actually did. I taught. It was optional, but I taught as well. And I feel like all of them are so interconnected. I understood everything in theory better after I practiced and saw what things were like on the ground. After I met with patients and got their experience, it like activated different thoughts that I had about the research and made me understand on a deeper level. That being said, there's always a power dynamic with patients. And so they're not going to be sometimes comfortable with being as direct as like students will when you're teaching and say, you know, you're just not explaining this concept well enough. At least a big part of my practice is psychoeducation. And so I'm often explaining things to patients, getting their intake or their impressions of it. And then we work through how it affects their experience of their life. And I think you get that in teaching as well, right? You explain a concept and then students make generalizations. They're all just, I guess, different faces of the same beast, for lack of a better metaphor.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense. So could you mind telling us a bit more about like your sort of research area, what you sort of wrote the PhD on? You mentioned AI. That sounds quite interesting. Yeah. Very sci-fi.
Nice. Yeah. And RIT, where I work, is a very sci-fi type of place. Well, my dissertation was, so initially I wanted to make a therapy video game for people with aggressive behavior. That's always been an interest of mine. How people's beliefs about themselves manifest in what appears to be impulsive behavior, or the fact that they don't really have a dialogue with themselves about how they're feeling or what they're thinking, kind of culminates in disruptive behavior. And so that's what I wanted to focus on, but I found that there wasn't much organization that I could use for a literature review. In designing a game for aggressive behavior, there's a lot out there on depression, anxiety, and those are the things that tend to be very well studied in the psychology research world. There's less organization around aggressive behavior. And so what my dissertation was a meta-analysis, so a study of studies and systematic review of all present e-health treatments for aggressive and disruptive behaviors. And so it was quite the undertaking. And I think maybe my dissertation committee shouldn't have approved it because it was so much work. I think that they were very, I can be very excited, and they got pretty excited and they were like, go for it. And I don't know how it is in the UK, but there's really the anger, aggression, they're not in the DSM as diagnoses. So it's just this like cluster of externalizing behaviors that's not really well organized or doesn't really align with any specific diagnosis. E-health treatments also are a giant umbrella. And so I had to organize all of those. And then how aggression presents is different by age group, right? So children versus adults. And then it tends to be targeted in different contexts. So like aggressive driving or aiding violence at campuses and stuff like that. So I had to organize each component of that. It was really intense.
I mean, it's funny how, like, you know, because you've just said there, you know, how like aggression is kind of not very well constructed in research, and how like e-health is an umbrella term. And it's funny because I was able to instantly like pull like a schema or like an idea of what I think those things are, but I could not give you like a textbook definition. It's really interesting in my, like, because I'm you know, psychology, video games as well, looking at mental health, but the big thing in video game research is video games violence. You know, we were talking about it the other day, about how the hot sauce methodology is used as a measure of aggression. What are your thoughts on that based upon your investigations into aggression?
Well, I'm not 100% familiar with the hot sauce thing that you were referring to. I definitely have a lot of opinions, as I think all psychologists in this area do, on violence in video games, and of course, leaning against there being a link. I mean, I don't know if you read some of those first studies on violence in video games that kind of kicked off the whole thing. But my understanding is that it was a lab that was already studying like violence in television or violence in movies, and they weren't having great results, not very consistent findings. And then the Columbine shooting happened and they moved their research into video games. And I think that they gave people a white noise burst in the middle of gaming, right? And then they measured how upset they got in response to the white noise burst. But I presented this when I was teaching as well. I think that it's pretty clear if you line it up that way, that people who get a white noise burst when they're like walking around their house or doing anything, that they'll get disrupted, will probably have a response to that. And it will be frustration and it probably will be verbal.
I honestly feel like mine would be like, ah!
yeah, exactly. And they'd be like, look at how aggressive he is.
So, he flailed, he's angry.
Yeah, and pretty reasonable.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. So the hot sauce methodology is that, you know, participant would come in, they would play a game, and then, you know, mostly they'd be a violent, non-violent games, like just say Grand Theft Auto or Madden for ease. That's not a specific paper. And then they would play the violent game, and then they'd say, okay, mm-hmm. Well, the next participant's coming in, pour some hot sauce on this food stuff for them. But the next person in isn't like an actual participant, they're usually a confederate or someone who's mm-hmm. pretending to be a participant. And they measure the amount of hot sauce put on as a measure of aggression. I don't know about you, but like, I just like spicy food, right? So I'd be like, well, you know, I this is how much I would put on. Or I'd maybe go the other way and be ultra cautious and be like, I know so many people that don't like spicy food, I put so little on. Like,
yeah,
measure of aggression. That's a bit reaching,
right? I can't, with all the work that I've had to do to justify even existing measures in my studies, I can't imagine how that would be legitimized as a operationalization of aggression, right? How does that represent the construct of aggression? And I would hope that, and I think that this is where a lot of people get lost in the weeds, and it's kind of unfair for people without a background in psychology, because I think you and I can talk about, like, did they control for people's, like you were saying, like, experiences with hot sauce? Did they ask people how often they eat spicy foods, or do they have a connection or schema in their mind where, like, hot sauce and, like, I don't know, having fun with friends are connected, right? In which case, if they often play games with friends as well, then that they'll be activated in that kind of mental space, and so they're going to be putting more hot sauce on, right?
So for the sake of listeners' benefit, like, so when we're talking about this, when in an ideal world, if you could construct an experiment, you would, with mm-hmm. some type of measurement, be able to control for every variable ever. So as, you know, Dr. Celeste just mentioned there, we'd be able to control for, do you have a preference for hot sauce? Do you associate that with other things? And then you would see how that affects your key measure, which would be, like, in this case, say, aggression. Spoiler, these studies didn't do that.
They never do.
This is why science mm-hmm. is hard. Like, you know, not to crack open a wider nut, but, like, there's a big movement going on at the moment about open science, pre-registration, the replication crisis. So, again, just for listeners' benefit, all that means is open science is releasing your data for other people to analyze so you can't fudge the numbers. Pre-registration is saying this is what you're going to do before you do it, like what data you're going to get, how you're going to collect it. So you're just being really mm-hmm. transparent. And that is sort of nestled in, you know, moral panic, replication crisis of people doing questionable things with hot sauce like that in video games. And then...
Yeah, I'd like to see their data. Yeah.
Well, I can tell you it's always the same in every study. The same authors always seem to mm-hmm. find exactly the same data, which is strange. So then we kind of got caught up in this process of, well, everyone's repeating the same studies to find out, because a measure of a good scientific study is that if you do it again, you will find something similar, right? And this is replication crisis. Everyone's kind of doing those studies. So again, when we're talking about this, we're like saying, well, you would want to control for all these things. Mm-hmm. And you can tell us a bit more about your meta-analysis, but what that does is you do a review of all the studies and all the data that people have submitted. So how what kind of stuff did you get? I don't mind if you get a bit statty.
Oh, yeah. It was quite a lot of work. So I started with, it's fresh in my mind because it was just defended, right? But one of the hardest or one of the first hurdles that we came up against, or that I guess I came up against since I was working pretty independently on this, was coming up with the keywords just to find e-health treatments. There's a lot of calls for a unified language when we talk about video games and digital treatments, but we're not there yet. And so really there's no way to find them. And even though there are these calls and people tend to use some words, they're not putting it in the keywords of their studies. So they're not tagging them as e-health treatments. So I had to come up with I'd say about 10 different words and put them all in quotes in the search engine. And then I had to do the same for aggression because, like I said, there's not a unified language for aggressive behavior either, or specific diagnoses really, because I wasn't looking for sociopathy. I wasn't looking for the 2% of violent people who are premeditated and really coldly looking at getting resources by hurting other people. I was looking more for that impulsive type of aggression. So with that search methodology, I initially pulled 20,000 studies. So that was obviously extremely unrealistic. Yeah, and I found that I was accidentally hitting every single study that had digital or computer in the body of the text. Mm. So, submitted these data to a digital database would come up. And so that was a lot of junk stuff to go through. So instead I had to confine it just to the title. I ended up eventually finding 3,000 that I had to go through title by title and then abstract by abstract. And
again, to interject there for mm-hmm. listeners' benefit, a systematic review is whereby you review literature, but in a very detailed and planned way. So what Dr. Celeste is describing here is that this process is you go title by title, abstract by abstract, and weed down until you find the studies that you really want to analyze the data from.
Mm-hmm. We ended with 11 that fit inclusion criteria. And then from those 11, I actually had to do, so this is a little atypical for meta-analysis, but a forward search and a backward search, which is I read all of those studies and every study that they cited for inclusion. And then I went forward and all of the studies that cited those studies I looked at as well. So that added an additional 2,000 or 3,000. And from that, I was able to pull it up to 33, which is a pretty good number. Not counting the ones that didn't have the right data included in their body to even use in the meta-analysis. I emailed a lot of researchers and most of them were happy to share their data, but just some weren't accessible. And so, yeah, that was very difficult and quite an intensive process. But then I went through all those studies, pulled the data, made a giant Excel database, then turned it into an SPSS database, then ran it through a meta-analysis software. And then it was done.
And then done. Excellent.
Yeah. It was interesting. I feel like you might have gone through this as well with your PhD, but the pandemic started right after I proposed my dissertation. And I was like, oh, I'm going to be working from home, so it'll be easier. It's completely unrealistic looking back on it, but I thought that it would be easier to do my work, which of course it wasn't because I was multitasking with being in a pandemic and everything else. So I think it was, looking back, quite difficult to be in a pandemic and doing the meat of my work on my dissertation. Yeah, especially since then there was a push to publish on e-health. And so I had a bunch of question marks in my head about whether that research would be the same as the research I was finding before.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. I mean, like, for, so, you know, for perspective, the start of this year, 2021, that's when I started. Well, I, as you mentioned, applied. I applied in 2020. I actually had my interview a week before the UK went into lockdown. So then obviously, like, everything just was like, yeah, it's on hold. And then I found out, like, in the summer that I'd be starting. So, I mean, I found starting during a pandemic really strange. I can't imagine actually working, like, on PhD stuff. I think that would almost be more challenging. Just, I want to talk about the e-health stuff just for a little bit as well. Because, I mean, I'm wearing a Fitbit. I use apps. I track a lot of stuff because I'm a data nerd. I love, like, looking at my own stats. I love RPGs. So, yes. So, how do you feel around sort of... I'm trying to think of a good way to phrase the question that's not too inflammatory. But so let's okay. So
yeah,
what in your mind is like a good idea of like an e-health intervention or product? Or
I have so many ideas.
Service?
Yeah. A good e-health app/service. Well, I guess I feel like this is a very not fun. Oh, you mean an existing one or one that
I come up with? Yeah, let's say an existing one for now.
Okay. Well, I actually use in practice very often an app called Virtual Hope Box. Have you heard of it?
I haven't.
It's a little sketchy in so much that it's made by the Department of Defense, which my patients will point out when we download it in session. But it is, so it opens into an interface that allows people to select into whether they want to engage in their coping skills, whether they want to just distract themselves, or whether they want to do, I think, two other things. One is like coping cards, and I forget what the other one is. But I find that self-selection to be really helpful. And if I'm doing deep breathing with a patient, so often in the beginning of meeting with patients, I explain what to expect in therapy, what my role is, what their role could be, how we can build it out. And then I'll go into the CBT model, how I use that. And often I'll start with deep breathing because I feel like it's a really accessible coping skill. It's often something that people are doing anyway, but often they don't know about doing it in a diaphragmatic way where they breathe in through their nose and out through their mouth in such a way that only their stomach moves. They probably don't know that they have to breathe in for 5 seconds and out for six. And then if they do it three times, they have a response, I think, in the parasympathetic nervous system, I've heard, which the sympathetic or parasympathetic.
I mean, if you're listening and you're safe and able to do so, give it a try.
But Virtual Hope Box has a great visual anchor for the deep breathing where it counts out and counts in for your breathing. I've used it in my personal life when people are having panic attacks around me and successfully had people disengage from panic attacks. At least I think I did it three times. Yeah, I can show it to you. I think it's a great app. I think that's not exactly what you were looking for, though, right?
No, that's actually a great answer because okay. What I was going to say was that I feel slightly uncomfortable with apps that are, like, marketed as mindfulness and as this will solve all your problems, but it kind of really does is, like, I mean, calming down is great, but, like, it's sold through moral entrepreneurism, quote, Dr. Kelly Dunlap, as like this will solve everything. It's like actually, like, you know, therapy might help, and I understand there are challenges around access to that, but like a subscription to an app like that isn't necessarily going to do you.
I agree completely.
The great, yeah. Greatest world of good.
Yeah, I agree completely, and I mean that was definitely something that I encountered in the dissertation I was doing the dissertation work. E-health apps. So I typed into like the app store. Like anger therapy and looked at all the apps that came up. And I want to say that there's no guidelines and no regulation on what they put in the app store, but I'm not sure that that's true because we're working on our therapy avatar for substance abuse and co-occurring violence. It's a project that I've entered into. And we're putting it on the App Store just for our patients. So people can't access it unless they're already in therapy. And then they can like download it and activate it with a code. And they're making us do a pretty extensive write-up for it. What our evidence base is for it being useful, what we're measuring, what we're collecting. But I don't know, maybe I'm being too idealistic. Maybe people just kind of write what looks good in those applications. And I guess it doesn't get evaluated by a psychologist. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that like I was surprised when you said that you're having to do any type of like application, because I mean, we've all seen how much crap you can get on an app store, right? Like, I mean, you look at the health section on your app store and there will be a 30-day apps. You know, mindfulness for everyone. And I'm not just ragging on those or anything, but it's like the fact that a lot of them are just like they just want money. They don't have your interests at heart, right? Moral entrepreneurism, as I mentioned before.
And I codified what I found when I was doing my dissertation was that the apps fell into four major categories. So fully automated, that's what you're talking about, where it's just do deep breathing and it's not based on anything and you're not in therapy. Maybe it's just like an informational website. Automated interactive, where there's some therapist involved in some way or someone trained. So maybe you're like using a platform, but it's asynchronous. So you get feedback from someone and they choose what module you do next or what like coping skill you focus on next. And then there's, what did I call it? I think I called it higher. Oh yeah. Technology enhanced was what I found the correct term was, for the next one, which was, you start traditional therapy and then the app is embedded inside the traditional therapy and you have access to it at home. So the way that I use Virtual Hope Box would be that I wouldn't just tell a patient or write the name down. I would first introduce things, then introduce the app in the context of what a coping skill is, plan out how they're going to use it outside of session, and then like help them download it. We would practice it. And then I'd follow up about that next week and what the barriers were and what the success was in using it. Or if it didn't work at all and they don't like it, and then we like do something completely different. I tell my patients all the time that there's hundreds, if not thousands, of coping skills. And a big part of the work is finding what works for them specifically and what resonates with them and what fits in their life. So even if there's a coping skill that resonates with them, it's adapting it to their life.
I just want to point out for like the sake of saying it for listeners as well, like, you know, not every type of therapy works for everyone. Not every therapist works for everyone. It's about, I think a lot of people look at it as just like a one directional kind of process, but it's bi-directional. Mm-hmm. Like you need to work with your therapist and not against them. It's a huge thing in like therapeutic settings, right?
Yeah. And I'm always telling my patients if they don't like what I'm doing to please tell me, because I would really like to course correct. And I also recognize that, you know, one of the, and I'm sure you're familiar with this research, the alliance between the therapist and the patient and the therapist's like, and patient's belief in what they're doing are two of the biggest predictors of how people do in therapy. And I recognize that even if I'm good at forming an alliance or even if I can build trust, I can't do that with everyone. I am a person, right? And so there's just some people that it's going to either be extremely hard or it's just never, we're never going to fully connect. And in that case, like it's possible to assign to another therapist and I won't take it personally.
So I know, again, we've talked about a couple of things here. Have you got anything else that you're kind of up to at the moment that you'd like to mention? I mean, you've got a lot on. You're a busy person.
Yeah. Well, when it comes to my dissertation, I think I described three of those app categories. The final one is therapist-led, where the app or technology is only present while the therapist is also present. So these are things like video recording that the therapist goes over with the patient, or I don't know if you're familiar with parent-child interaction therapy, but it's a type of therapy where parents first get training in how to, I guess, interact with their children. And they actually go, and there's a double or a one-sided mirror, and the therapist is in their ear with a chip, kind of guiding them in what they could be doing to interact with their children. So that would be an example of something that was embedded just while the therapist was present. And my findings were that the technology enhanced and therapist led e-health treatments were the only ones that were effective. So I think that speaks to what you were saying, that these like, platforms that you can download aren't really changing much.
I mean, you heard it here first, folks. We got the data, we've got the meta-analysis yeah. to back it up. There you go.
Yeah, and I think, some of my colleagues are kind of disappointed about it. I think, you know, like I said, we had the platform and the avatar that we were working on, or that they were working on before I got there. It's grant-funded. It's like a whole big deal. And I think they kind of wanted it to be automated, but now we're restructuring it so that it's embedded within, like, first you meet with a therapist, they go over what therapy is, why, and how treatment can help you if you're a co-occurring substance user and have a history of intimate partner violence. And then the avatar therapist just kind of reiterates and covers that in a different way and walks you through pretty much the sessions that you've just gone through. But as a reminder, and I think that that is what makes the most sense. It's a lot of pressure on patients to remember everything in a 50-minute session and then to take it out of treatment and try to generalize it into their daily life. So anything that we can give them to maximize their chance to remember it, to rehearse it, I think can really be helpful in therapy. And that's what I'm thinking the technology can be most helpful for, increasing accessibility.
This is going to sound maybe like a daft, like, reverse question, but, like, do you think we can reach a point where AI will be so good it can be more automated? Again, I know, like before we went on air, we were talking about ELIZA, which was, like, the first sort of automated, like, AI therapy program. It's also a game that deals with that sort of subject. Like, do you think we can get there? Like, what are your opinions on that?
You know, we were talking about this just the other day, and I know that they made a chatbot that did Rogerian therapy, a chatbot that did just reflections. And so if that's what you're looking for, then I think that does exist, right? But I think, well, I guess I'm saying that chatbots are often overlooked. If you're looking for like a robot that looks like a human, I think we're pretty far from that. I think our avatar is a little scary. It's a little in the uncanny valley, it is what it is. I don't know. I've been, let me first address your question, because I realized I was going to go off into a tangent. I think that we're pretty far off. And I tell my colleagues, once the AI gets sophisticated enough, I think that we'll actually be giving it more feedback. Like, it'll need more guidance from the psychologist. I don't know
if that. Okay.
Question. Yeah.
No, that's fair. Because I mean, it's one of those, I think, I really enjoy sci-fi dystopia. It's my favorite genre of book. And there is this kind of idea that, like, you know, we have the technology to do it by itself. Mm-hmm. But you pointed out something really important there, in that, like, these chatbots that can direct you to resources, like, exist, and that's kind of the important thing. Like, they're in the of themselves, like, inherently not necessarily like seeking to monopolize in anything or potentially trying to give you robotic therapeutic advice, right? But it's like, either we keep it at that and then, you know, I don't know, make therapy more affordable, controversial opinion,
exactly. Yeah, yeah.
But, like, again, that part of me, because, you know, capitalism, like, feels that they are going to try and make these bots that do more.
They will try. I think so. I agree with you. Yeah. I'm definitely with you with anything that appears marketable. Even if researchers say that it won't be marketable, the market's going to try to give it a shot. Until, sadly, I think that the way that we develop protections is that something negative has to happen and then the law adjusts to create more protections for people. But yeah, I think to your point, there's this and I forget what it's called. My friends who study like human machine interaction work and other things, and like UX design can probably speak to it more, but there's this pressure to replicate the therapist in a digital format versus just create a new space for what e-health could do, right? So it's not look like, I think that when you create this pressure to replicate something that exists, you miss out on the unique things that could be done in the virtual space and kind of what you have directly in front of you in digital settings. So I'll give you a really good example. A project that I'm trying to build out at RIT is on one of the robots, like therapy robots that we were trying to build for an inpatient hospital unit with children, children who had experienced sexual abuse. And initially the therapy robot kind of looked like Wally. I was like, why do all the therapy robots, why do we have this like conception in our mind that robots all have to look a certain way and that there has to be just one of them, where we can make something completely unique as to like a robot therapist that doesn't exist anywhere else. So we can make the robot therapist look more like a Sesame Street character or like a Sesame Street cast, right? Mm. Instead of it being just one robot with a lot of different functions, because we have this preconception that there's the one therapist with all the different functions that they can do. We can have one robot that is a little less approachable and children have to like learn boundaries from it. Then we have a robot that's very friendly, you know, and we can even have a robot that like a large one with like a little one on its shoulder and they like talk to each other or something like that. Because I think the automatons that we have right now in like the therapy robots, they just kind of come to life when you come up to them, and that's pretty frightening, right? But if they look like they're doing something, or and if it's a whole cast and they look like they're interacting with each other, that I think can make them pretty approachable.
Sorry, for listeners' benefit, I was like nodding along profusely there. I feel like, so two things kind of popped into my mind. One was like, imagine having therapy with like the Cookie Monster, and then going in like the next week, going in and having it with Elmo. But then the thought that crept into my mind as we continued that discussion was like Five Nights at Freddy's. Like the way you described the automatons that just come to life, like that then sounded terrifying.
Yeah, and I think we're more like that right now because we're trying so hard to force it to be like the therapist, where I don't know, you like walk into a therapist's office and they're like, they like sit with you or something. Whereas
I mean, and this is again, I hate to break listeners' like thoughts here, but like therapists are people. They do like they go to the toilet, they curse, they drink tea. All this happens when, like, you don't leave the room and then they just disappear in, like, a poof of smoke.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But with the therapy robots, they do kind of come alive when someone goes to interact with them. And that is very frightening, you know? And so if we have them do something else or have a greater world in the way that therapists do, I think it'll make them a lot less intimidating. And it'll also make them occupy a different space. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is the whole idea behind the uncanny valley, right, is that people have an image in their mind of what robots are supposed to look like and what people are supposed to look like, and the discomfort comes from the like object occupying the space in between and not being enough like the robot image or the human image. And I think that we're forcing the therapy robots into that space as well, but we're trying to make them be something that is uncanny behaviorally, whereas we can just build something out. And so my research is going to start with what people's schemas are for a puppet, for a robot, for a therapist, and then see what I can build out as that space that the therapy robots can occupy. I think that we can also do things that are pretty unique. Like they don't even always have to be robots, right? They can be in the corner of a room doing their own thing. And then there can also be a computer with a little like animated version of the therapy robot, right? They can have a little avatar and people can interact with them as their avatar version, or they can choose if they want to go up to the robot, right? So if they want to approach them slowly, they can in that way.
Yeah, so that, I mean, that kind of like leads into one of my other questions, sort of like, you know, what's kind of next for your work? But I think, like, I'm listening to that and, like, I'm excited. I'm like, that's like a, because, you know, ultimately when we're talking about this kind of system, we're talking about therapy, I've mentioned almost joking, like, if only therapy was affordable and accessible. That's not like the fault of therapists, and it's not the fault of people that need/want therapy, right? It's the fault of why the system. I don't want to go into a big capitalist rant or anything.
I know, right?
I could, yeah. But I won't.
I also could, yeah.
So this is kind of looking at a way of like, well, how do we provide a space and tools to make it more accessible, right? And this is like it's a bit frightening to sort of conceive conceptually, but like, yeah, like this is maybe a way, right? And it's, as you say, it's beyond this, like, here's an app, go chill for 10 minutes and the world will be a better place.
Exactly. Yeah, it's an auxiliary. Like, if you have children who are hospitalized in an inpatient unit and they have a sexual abuse history, right, which is what these therapy robots would be for, they're living on the unit, right? And so realistically, their time is spent not always with therapists. They have group therapy, they have individual therapy, and then they interact with the other children on the unit. But the therapy robot room would just be another room of many that they can choose to go into. And so the idea is that these resources add to existing therapy, and then they free up some of the pressure on the patients to remember everything in therapy. They're another mechanism at getting at the same therapeutic stuff. And so it can accelerate their treatment in making it more accessible. And it also frees up the therapist resources, because they don't have to kind of continuously make the patient go through these things over and over again. Of course, there's always going to be rehearsal. It's a really big part of therapy. But the rehearsal could be in the context of discussing how things came up with peers and with the therapy robots and with the avatar, and then how we're going to build that out in this session while planning what they're going to do next time in between sessions.
I know you, I mean, you have kind of half answered this already, but I'll ask again for the, you know, it's written down, so I'm going to ask it. Like, so what, you're kind of doing a lot right now. What is kind of like the next steps? Like, if you were going to say,
I'm sorry, I realized you asked that.
This is the roadmap. What's kind of next? Like, after what you're currently doing?
Yeah. Well, the therapy robots are a big project that is kind of slow moving. One of my biggest projects right now is I work at a homeless shelter, and we're building out a few different digital interventions there. The first is a systemic intervention. And so it's going to be a website where both staff and residents can access resources for the shelter, can access a directory of people. And then also has actually the avatar that I spoke about. So accessibility to coping skills rehearsal, coping skills teaching. And the reason for that is that, I think the reason for the homeless shelter residents is fairly straightforward. We're also doing therapy there. There's this pressure to push people who are homeless into housing without getting at the underlying mechanisms of what has kind of contributed to their homelessness, right? Or what is associated with their homelessness. So often people have trauma related to the experience of becoming homeless, or a big portion of the people at the shelter I work at have psychosis and mania, because it's a shelter where it's all adults. And so we're getting them into housing while at the same time treating these co-occurring mental illnesses. But there's often a focus on the people in the shelter and their mental health, and no emphasis on the people who work there. And there's a really high rate of burnout among shelter workers. They get no training. They're often the first line of defense when someone's aggressive or psychotic or pretty much anything is happening. And so we're going to implement mental health resources for them, connecting them to therapy, and then they're going to have the same access to the coping skill of rehearsal. That way, instead of putting all the pressure on the residents to work on their mental health while also trying to get housing, we're giving the same treatment to ourselves as employees and the staff that are there. I know that was very long.
That was a fantastic answer. And like, honestly, like, I'm like, wow, that is, again, you touch on so many like broader issues there, and there's a lot of finesse to kind of work around, but like, that is like, yeah, wow, that's like a big issue that you're trying to work on. And like the mention of like looking at like after staff as well, like that's huge. That is wow, big wow.
We're also trying to build an, I don't know how realistic this is, but I'd really like to build an electronic health record into the platform, so that patients can, or the residents can see their own information, and then the staff can also see what people are working on, because you've probably worked at hospitals, right? They always have electronic health records. My clinic has an electronic health record, but shelters don't. There's so much pressure on the staff to meet the resident. The resident's in crisis. What do they need? Like, and they have to redo the work. And then the person in front of them is, of course, stressed out because they've told their story about all these things that are happening to them so many times, if they even have the resources in that moment to recall them, right? So someone with like active psychosis, they have moments of clarity, and also moments where things are more intense for them. And as they get more stressed, it's going to be harder and harder to access their memories and their thoughts. So yeah, there really should be an electronic health record, and hopefully we can make it.
I mean, again, so this maybe question sounds, I almost feel a bit daft asking it, because what you're doing sounds so impressive, if you'll pardon the flattery. But like, if you had like no limitations at all, like blue sky, you had unlimited access to funding and participants and services, what would your like ideal like research project be? Because obviously, you know, you're gonna research something and make sure that it all is validated and tested. What would that big blue sky study be? I always reference that my one would be, the game Celeste, the platformer.
Oh yeah, yeah.
For me, it's the perfect game. It has notes about mental health. It's challenging. Mm-hmm. The soundtrack is just dope.
I listen to it when I do research. Yeah.
I would want people to play that and do a longitudinal study on their experience with the game and that sort of thing. If I had unlimited time, money, access to participants, and a life, so what would yours be? Big blue sky.
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to make more. Right now, I feel like I'm actually where the field is at. Like, there's just so little organization in e-health and virtual interventions for behavior that we are laying the groundwork to support that it's even useful and what is useful. And like you said, the market has gotten so involved that there's this like influx of health apps that are such bad representations. I don't mean to be judgmental, but aren't great representations of mental health apps. And so I'm happy to be laying that groundwork. Like I said, like the systemic platform is part of that, and addressing like needs right now. But I really want to make mental health video games. So I love Mass Effect. It's one of my favorite games. And I would love to have and I would need so many financial resources for this, unless the studio that made Mass Effect wants to reach out to me and do this together. But I'd love to have an intervention where patients are controlling a character that they designed that had this whole personality test that the Mass Effect characters that you kind of had during the character creation. And through their avatar, they encounter situations that elicit the same or activate the same underlying conditions that would happen in the real world if they were to become aggressive or engage in risk behaviors. And then it starts with untimed responses. So I can talk to them in therapy, or we can design a treatment where the therapist talks to them about their decision process. And there's also measures of like skin conductivity and arousal. We can do coping skills, and then help them select the more like adaptive or healthier option that's so aligned with what they want. And then they can get people's reactions in real time in the game environment. And then as they progress through treatment, they get more and more timed responses to be more aligned with their like increasing capabilities.
That is big brain.
Yeah.
Big brain.
I'd really like to do that. Yeah, I've been wanting to do it since I like played Mass Effect back when I started my PhD, but sadly, I mean, gaming moves a lot faster than research. We're just not there yet.
couple things. The first one is I'll put my hands up high. I've not played Mass Effect, it is on my list.
Oh, it's so good.
I know it's meant to be amazing. The second thing is that, again, that sounds amazing, like mental health related games, like that's actually my research area. There is not enough of them. The ones that are there, questionable in quality at times, like it's very difficult to find. Like, put it this way, I had a real time trying to find games that I could use as like testing sort of thing for participants. Again, in the context of research, like that weren't like massive, say Hellblade Senzura Sacrifice, that's a 12-hour experience. Like asking participants to sign up to play that for the full 12 hours to get the full narrative experience is a big
full 12 hours.
Is that, like, you couldn't do that, right? I've had to look at like alternatives, so like maybe while that, or like Celeste for example, I have played that for like 60 hours. I can't ask a participant to do that during a PhD, right? So I've had to look at alternatives. Yeah. So like, yeah, games like that, big call for it. Okay, so last work-related question. Just how many years do you think it'll be before I can claim to have the first big interview with like Dr. Celeste?
Well, my middle school yearbook said most likely to become a famous psychologist. So I thought that was cute. I mean, especially at the time, I was like I was a little like, I don't want to say edgelord. I don't want to judge myself too hard, but I was like, psychology is a soft science. It's stupid. I've grown as a person since then. So I don't know. I guess we'll see. We'll see if the yearbook prediction comes true. But I'm just going to be plugging away on my research.
I mean, I have an inkling that it might be right. Just an inkling. Okay, so we've talked a lot about, you know, your work there. What about when you're not working? You mentioned a little bit about the stuff you like to get up to. What's for fun? Mm-hmm. What do you play? What else? Tell us about that.
Less fun? I spent a lot of time yesterday playing Disco Elysium. I don't know if you've played that. It's pretty fun. Or at least I'm enjoying it so far. We'll see how it goes. Definitely game. Fiance and I are trying to learn Unity so that we can make some games ourselves. I have a few. I really appreciate the dating sim format, or like those, not necessarily dating sims, but just visual novels.
Visual novels, yeah.
Yeah, and so I would love to play around with that. One of the test projects I want to make as I learn those skills is a dating sim around, are you familiar? I forget the name of the conference, but there was this big conference at Clark University where all of the big names in early psychology showed up. So like Freud was there, Jung was there. I want to say Pavlov was there, but maybe I'm getting my Pavlov and Piaget confused. probably Pavlov, I think he's older. Gene Stanley Hall, like, all these old names in psychology were there, and I want to use the dating sim as a way to provide psychoeducation. And so it goes over each of these early psychologists' like worldview and like theory of psychology, and then you can date them also. It'd be a really fun, cute thing.
In the conference. I'm just thinking about how funny it would be to date Freud.
And
like, it's like I can imagine his response to that. Like, Freud would definitely date himself, right? 100% he would date himself. Mm-hmm. He would say he was going to take Jung to the dance, and then would take himself. We all know it.
I don't know. I always see him as, I know Dream Daddy is a game, but like, you know, he's the original Dream Daddy because he's Freud, right? Yeah, he would be real messy. So I think it would be an exciting thing to make. So that's one of the things we're working on. I guess I'm planning my wedding as well, which takes some time. And yeah, those are the things that I'm doing now.
That's pretty awesome. I mean, like game design, you know, it's something that I want to do more of. I've thought about maybe going back and like doing like a master's in it or something. Like, yo, I'm making that sound way easier than it is. I'm not downplaying it. It's just like that would be like the entrance route for me personally, like academically, just to be able to have that, because I feel like a lot more of the world has become aware of the overlap between psychology and video games. Like psychologists and game designers have like almost always known it, although maybe video game designers weren't bothered. You know, maybe. That's an opinion, not a fact. So, like, I feel like, you know, people like Dr. Kelly Dunlap, like Celia Holden, you know, like, they're actively involved in the industry. Dr. Celia Holden, by the way. And, like, being able to get that experience and bring it all together myself. Like, you know, yeah, PhD in psychology, video games, mental health, but I also want to make one, you know.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's most frustrating to me is that the fields don't talk to each other. Like, I started in personality psychology, and so few clinical psychologists are even familiar with the premises, at least in the US. I don't know if it's different. I mean, I heard you talking about schemas, but I think some of my colleagues wouldn't be familiar with the term, even though schema therapy is a type of, but people don't really do schema therapy as much here. I heard it's bigger in Europe. But yeah, personality psych doesn't talk to, even within psychology, the fields don't talk to each other. And even more so with other fields. So we're lucky at RIT, and one of the reasons I tried so hard to work in a place like this is we do have a multidisciplinary team. So with that robot project I was talking about before, I work with a human interaction, human-machine interaction specialist. For all of our digital projects, we have medical illustration and programmers. And so we have a team of people that we speak to. But RIT is also offering the possibility to take like game design classes. So I think I'm going to do that, because I think even though we're having these meetings with each other, we're not speaking the same language. Although I did tell some of the programmers that I was just going to open up Unity and see what I could do. And they started laughing. I think they thought I was joking. and I was like, I guess that's fair. I guess it is pretty, maybe naive to think I can just jump into Unity.
I think like the problem, not the problem with Unity, but like I'm like a very little bit of familiarity with it. And I think one of the challenges is that Unity is designed in a kind of way where you can kind of open it and they're like, make your first game in 5 minutes. And that's great from like I'm a layperson who wants to pick up Unity. But like what it maybe doesn't teach you is like you need to learn machine code and you're using pre-selected rendered assets. Gotta make those usually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think, our avatar therapist is completely built from the ground up. So I think maybe they thought that that's what I meant instead of something that was mostly illustration that was just put together in like an existing game engine format that could be like uploaded into Unity. I don't even know if I'm using the right language. It's so complicated.
I'm sure someone in the YouTube comments will let us know. okay, that's
I'm always
great.
Happy to learn.
So, have you played anything else good? So you've been playing Disco Elysium, anything else like recently that sort of comes out tonight?
Let's see, what was that game that was good? I love all the Tales games. I was playing, I get all their names confused. The Tales game with Yuri. Do you know which one that is?
No, I'll be honest. I've only seen...
I want to say Vesperia, I think it is.
I've only seen... I can't even think of the rest of the names.
Yeah. Well, I was really enjoying that. My fiancé is playing Skyward Sword, which he never played, and I'm really enjoying watching him play that. I'm a big Zelda fan. I have a Triforce tattoo. So.
Nice. I don't know if you can see it in my background, but like I've actually got the Legend of Zelda Joy-Cons sitting on a shelf back there.
Awesome.
So I'm a bit of a fan.
Nice.
What I've got to ask then, you know, favorite Zelda game?
Oh gosh, I don't know. They're all charming. I actually think that Skyward Sword might be my favorite one. I don't know. Maybe it's just because I'm watching it be played now. No, I mean, in addition to studying psychology, my undergrad, I also studied religion. I double majored in psychology, and my religion thesis was on the Ocarina of Time.
Hello. Can I get a copy of that?
Well, I don't know. I think my writing has changed a bit from undergrad. I would love to publish that paper though, but it was on, just like all the different components of Ocarina of Time, culture heroes as like new experiences of religion, right? When you define religion, what is it? It's a way of like seeing the world around you, like a filter. And so people use superheroes and video games and things like that to make sense of the world around them. And so it goes from there. I guess I'd have to say it was Ocarina of Time. I did both Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask in my religion thesis.
Okay, so not only does that sound incredibly interesting to me, so I definitely like, yeah. I'd read that. I'm going to throw up like a spoiler warning, but I feel like at this point, anyone who hasn't played Ocarina of Time just isn't going to, because it's been available.
Yeah, gosh, was it 20 years ago?
So many formats. It's like that joke of like Final Fantasy VII has been spoiled for everyone already. Like, I feel like Ocarina of Time has as well, because it's been so... it's always in the top five of best games ever lists, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is your view, and particularly maybe with that religious lens on, of the ending of Ocarina of Time? Because obviously Link is kind of, frozen in time. He's made up as an adult. He does the business. At the end of the game, Zelda just kind of sends him back and he's a kid again. I've seen critiques of that ending being like, that's actually really cruel because he's a Hylian being forced to live with, the Deku, like the Deku people, the fairy people in the forest. He's an orphan. Mm-hmm. And like just kicking him back as a child where it's proposed that he never meets Zelda is actually really harsh. And obviously when you put that in context of Majora's Mask is supposed to be a sequel, that doesn't exactly end well for Link either.
So my understanding of it was that Majora's Mask is one of a few possible, right, like ways that it could have gone after Ocarina of Time. But the way that I used Joseph Campbell in the Hero's Quest to analyze Ocarina of Time, and he goes through this first realm of his, or this first leg of his quest, where he is meeting everybody and kind of understanding these world principles. And then in the second leg, where he's an adult, he is understanding their like deeper symbolic value. That's just the very like quick summary of like 40 pages of thesis. And they literally become a bridge, right? So he incorporates them in such a way that they scaffold him into this like final thing where he, I don't know how familiar you are with Hero's Quest, but he like fights the ogre father and like joins with like the goddess mother, right? That's a component. And so the final component after that, or then you do the magical flight, right? So you're escaping from the castle as it's falling apart. After you do that escape, you return with a potion, right? That's the final thing. So you return with the knowledge of the quest, and then you incorporate it back into your mundane everyday life. And so I think that that's how the whole journey gets sealed. He becomes like who he was at the beginning. My understanding was that it was, he has all the memories of everything and he goes back and he is now going to disseminate it into how he experiences reality. And if you look at Majora's Mask, everything's a bizarro version of what he had experienced in Ocarina of Time. And he really is just traveling with that potion and like curing other people's ills and their troubles.
It's not a plug, I'm going to say that, just to preface this, but have you read The Psychology of Legend of Zelda?
So I haven't. I have a book somewhere that's the, like, it's all religious articles on The Legend of Zelda, but not the psych one yet.
It's very good. It's edited by Dr. Anthony Bean. It's got like different authors that wrote different things. Like one is the Kugo Rossi model of grief is like symbolic in Majora's Mask and how that plays out in the game. It's a really good book. Would recommend it if you. I mean, you've probably like written half of it without knowing it. It's really, really good. I'm gonna put this out there. I've said this before. Minish Cap is an underrated Legend of Zelda game. I would say it's arguably the best.
Those offshoot ones are so fun. Like the Minish Cap. I was just talking to my fiance about Oracle of Ages and Seasons. Just Link being in a little kangaroo pouch and jumping around is just like so silly. I love it. I don't know. They're just all the handheld games were so charming.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's definitely there. Do you think we'll get a Legend of Zelda 3D like All-Stars pack? Do you think it'll happen?
Oh, that would be nice. I can't imagine it, but I would like it.
I like 10 out of 10 like would buy but like what would they put on it, because I mean a few people have been like, well, Twilight Princess and Wind Waker, they were on the Wii U, they'd be an easy port. You know, mm-hmm. people want to see like obviously Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask, you know, like we've already got Skyward Sword, but obviously if you're going to marry mm-hmm. it up with the Super Mario one, it would be N64, GameCube, then a Wii. And people are like, well, we can't have just one of each of those. That's not enough.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so hard to get all the, like, I have all the older consoles from when I used to, when they were the present consoles. Nice. And it's hard to like set them up, and they don't stay on in the same way as this. I've just gotten so used to the Switch and the PlayStation 4. It's hard to go back to like a GameCube after that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it is very frustrating not to be able to play the older games. And I do, like, I think in my mind, I don't want to believe it, but I feel like we're never going to get the Minch Cap or any of those, like, handheld games re-released. They're just, like, too silly. And Nintendo's, like, a serious. And I feel like Breath of the Wild is such a serious. Like, they want people to take Zelda more seriously now. I don't know. That's just my worry, I guess.
Honestly, you say that, and it's like, well, how could you access them nowadays? Like, you can get Oracle mm-hmm. of Seasons and Ages on the 3DS eShop, but, like, buying stuff on that is a real pain in the backside now. You gotta, like, mm-hmm. go online and add credit to it and then download it that way, which is an effort. And then, like, you know, Minish Cap, like, I only have it on a 3DS because I was part of the 3DS Ambassador Program, because I bought them when they first came out, because nerd. But, like, otherwise, like, unless you got, I mean, it might be on the Wii U Virtual Console in Europe, but, like, even then, like, I'm one of, like, seven people I know that ever owned a Wii U.
Yeah, I'm a Wii U,
Like, so it's, you know, these great games exist, they're just incredibly difficult to get to, right?
Yeah. And like I said, I do think that, like, they're a little too, like, silly and weird. And there has been this push to make gaming very serious. Or at least in my, I don't know, is that something that you've thought about? I think I've seen more of a push to make, especially AAA games, like, very serious and structured in content.
Well, I mean, it's that old joke, isn't it, of, like, you know, most modern games are a combination of grey and brown and usually a first-person shooter.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know, I liked, and this is something I've read, that with, I think, Link's Awakening, they were going for like a David Lynch type of thing, that the writing team had, I think, watched Twin Peaks or one of the David Lynch movies, and that's what they were trying to approximate with all the different, like, cast of characters that you meet and how, like, dreamlike and strange they are when you interact with them. And that's just, like, it's so charming and nice. I would really like to have that experience. Well, I guess I'll just get it in other games now. I don't want to push Zelda to be something. It's change is natural, and it's nice to see it evolve over time. It doesn't have to be what it was like when I was young.
That's true. Nostalgia is a powerful and potent and dangerous thing.
Yeah. And there's plenty of like charming puzzle games out there. And if anything, it's an opportunity to learn about more of them and see more different types of games.
What's sort of the next game like on your playlist?
Such a good question. It was Disco Elysium and I just started it just a few days ago. Oh, but you know, I just bought a bunch of games. I bought the Ace Attorney series. Nice. Yeah, I played Phoenix Wright back in the day, but this is one with a different character, so I'm very excited about playing that. As you've probably gathered since we've talked about it a few, or I've mentioned it a few times, my fiance and I like to game together, and the detective games are something that we play together often because we can like problem solve and we talk through like what the next decision is going to be and have you looked at this part of the screen and stuff. So I really like those types of games that, even if they're not designed to be played in as a group, are amenable, or that you can kind of make interesting.
Nice. Okay, so last couple of questions are sort of quick fire. So You get one film, album, one book, one video game, like on a desert island. I always like to say a retreat. You're not like stranded. You're going away by choice because we all need a bit of relaxing because burnout's a real thing. What do you take with you?
Okay. You said one book, one movie, and one game?
And one album.
And one album. Okay. I'll start with game. And I feel like this is unfair because I'm just going to say... Oh, can I say the new version of Mass Effect that has all three games on it?
Yep.
Yeah, that's something like, what, over 100 hours of gameplay? So I think that would mostly take care of the desert island, but I'll say more. Okay, so one game, one album? That's something I've listened to a lot. I'd probably take a Cat Stevens album. I want to say Tea for the Tiller Man. Listen to that a bunch of times. So D for the Doorman. One book. What's a book I would take? Probably The Hunger Games.
Yeah, nice. I mean, you, compilation or just the first one?
I think I'd have to take the compilation. otherwise, it's going to be so painful, right?
It's one of those where, like, I've definitely seen them sold in one box set. So, like, that's totally legit. Mm-hmm. Like, that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, speaking about marketing, right? I feel like The Hunger Games is all about, like, digital media marketing and like individual experience.
And then one film, movie.
Oh, one film. Gosh, I really don't watch films that often. Can I see a TV show instead?
What, or is that what, like one yeah. DVD? Then let's say that.
Okay. I really like. I really like Korean soap operas, so I'd say one of the Korean soap operas I watch, maybe it's called My Girlfriend is a Gamiho. I don't know if you've ever watched it.
Never heard of it, I'll be honest.
Yeah, translates to My Girlfriend is a Nine-Tailed Fox.
Okay.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a coming-of-age story, actually about, it's about individualizing as an adult and getting a greater sense of self, both the human character becoming more human and the like supernatural character literally becoming human. So it's got nice like mirror narratives.
Nice. And then last yeah. but not least, do you have any questions for me?
Well, you've been a great host and I feel like I've talked about so many things. Yeah, and you've mentioned so many interesting things. I'm really interested in your game work, but I think that's probably something that we can talk offline a bit if you want to.
That's fine.
It's not, what would be your book, movie?
Oh, you know? No. Okay. So no one's asked me that. That's it. And I haven't really thought about it. So I'll just
reel them off.
Okay. So I feel video game, I probably take a Pokemon game. I'd take maybe Pokemon Soul Silver. Great mileage in that. Book, I'd probably just take one of my favorites, like Perks of Being a Wallflower is up there. Album wise, it'd have to be, and I know like the titles now, knowing what I know now, like it's kind of loaded, but Fall Out Boy's Folly A Deux They're one of my favorite bands. Like, and yeah, it's album nice. Title aside, like, that's great. Film, that's a tougher one, but I think again,
it
like,
is, it's hard.
I'd just take one of my favorites. I'd just take The Mask with Jim Carrey. It was one of my favorite films as a child.
Oh yeah.
It's,
wow, I haven't heard of that in a while.
There's a heck of a lot of like metaphor and psychological imagery in there, but yeah, it's still funny.
I love that. Yeah.
I'll be honest, I haven't watched it in quite a few years, so I don't know if it's aged anywhere.
Right?
I might have to check that out.
Yeah, I worry about that too with The Mask. I feel like a lot of Jim Carrey stuff hasn't aged very well. Not a blanket statement, but oh gosh, you made me want to amend my answers. I realized that so in between doing research or even patient work, if I ever need to cool down, I'll play Super Mario Brothers 3. Like, I just always have it on every platform. I wonder if that's what that would take. Because it's just always so nice to have it. You can just jump right in. I feel like I know the whole map and
cracking game, by the way, just saying.
I don't know if you know the band World Inferno, but I think that's actually probably the album I would take. Listen to them, a bunch of stuff. It's one of their albums.
Okie doke. Well, all that remains for me to do is once again thank you, my very special guest. I hope you've enjoyed being on the show. I've enjoyed this chat. I hope you have all enjoyed listening. All those recommendation stuff will be attached in the description to wherever you found this and all those sorts of things. But I will now just move over to the ending screen and we will say farewell for another episode of Psyched to Be With You. As ever, look after your mind, body and soul, and we will see you again very, very soon. Farewell, everyone. Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Psyched to Be With You. I really hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. As ever, if you did enjoy it, please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really, really helps. If you want to keep up with all things Blind Psyche, check out the episode description for a link, or you can go direct to linktr.ee/blindpsyche. Thank you so much for listening. As ever, look after your mind, body, and soul, and I will see you again very, very soon. Bye-bye.